This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. I'm joined today by one of my producers, Blake Maples. We wanted to chat with you just briefly today about some technical difficulties we had with the previous episode. Welcome, Blake.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott.
During the last episode, we had a lot of background noise become too loud, and so we've corrected that issue.
What is involved typically with pulling off a podcast that comes out every day like this for a trial?
That's a really good question, Blake. Typically what happens is this. I drive into the courthouse. I spend 9 hours there covering the trial and doing follow-up interviews at the courthouse. Then I come back to the room I'm staying in and I do follow-up interviews. And then I take all those interviews, have them transcribed online. I write a script based on those things. And then I send them off to one of the producers. And in the middle of the night, those are pieced together. Usually I get done with my work around midnight. And then a producer takes up his work and works for a few more hours. And then first thing in the morning, maybe around 6, I listen to the episode and make sure it's what I would like it to be. Unfortunately, when I reviewed the last episode, it wasn't quite what I wanted it to be. There was a lot of background noise in the episode, and I didn't like it at all. And I was left with two choices. One, and neither one of them was perfect. One was not send an episode out that day because I didn't like the background noise coming through. The problem with that is it's depriving the listeners of information, and I don't like to do that. Or two, hope that the listeners are going to be understanding and go ahead and provide them with the information and then follow up and explain that we've addressed the technical difficulties that led to that problem and hope to move forward and continue to produce. But this is a very different endeavor than producing something where you have months to work on it. We're literally producing this in a matter of hours on deadline to get it out every day during this trial for the next month. So I can guarantee you a couple of things. One, that we're going to do our very best. And two, that there's going to be more technical glitches that we have to address in this next month. But I ask for your patience and your understanding, and I want to share with you my commitment to doing good journalism.
My position is, and I take it to my grave, I never hit a report in my life.
If this man is convicted, he's going to be convicted because of innuendo. He's going to be convicted of race. In my opinion, this is a razor-thin case. In a lot of jurisdictions, this man would not even be charged. This is a horrific crime. But the only thing that's almost as horrific would be convicting an innocent person.
Who will decide whether Stanley Liggins finishes 28 years behind bars a free man or spends the rest of his life in prison? Ultimately, that decision will rest in the hands of 12 ordinary Iowans. But what 12? That will likely be decided today. On Wednesday, Scott County Attorney Mike Walton and Assistant Scott County Attorney Julie Walton questioned and accepted a panel of 41 prospective jurors. That panel came from a pool of 170. A high school teacher, an air traffic controller, a truck driver, a Blackhawk County politician, a factory worker, and others were among those on the panel from which the jury will be chosen. The Waltons asked prospective jurors about their occupations, family, whether they've served on a jury before, how they felt about being called for jury duty, and how they felt about seeing graphic photos that will be shown during the case. Stanley Liggins' public defenders, Aaron Haubacher and Nicole Watt, today will have their chance to question the panel. Once both sides accept a panel of 41 prospective jurors, attorneys will then whittle down the panel to select the final jury. Robert Hirschhorn, a high-profile jury consultant who selected the juries in the George Zimmerman and William Kennedy Smith cases, told Suspect Convictions this will be a difficult case for the state to win.
It takes lawyers that believe in their client, because if outcomes of cases were determined by how horrific the crime is, there'd be a lot of innocent people in prison, and that's not what we want to do in this country. We want to make sure that before we convict someone of a crime, that it's not based on the nature of the crime, but it's based on the quality of the evidence. And I got to tell you, in my opinion, this is a razor-thin case. In a lot of jurisdictions, this man would not even be charged.
Judge Marlita Grieve instructed the potential jurors to abstain from watching news programs, reading newspapers, or other mediums that may have information about the trial. There are a variety of matters the court wants jurors to be unaware of. Among them are that Stanley Liggins failed a police lie detector test in September 1990, that he has previously been convicted of armed robbery and sexual abuse in unrelated cases, that juries have twice convicted Liggins in the murder of Jennifer Lewis and twice appellate courts have ordered new trials, that he knew Jennifer's family because he was selling cocaine to her parents. The question remains whether the jurors will honor the judge's order or will learn about the case in other ways. For example, one potential juror described his wife as a gossip and said she was eager to tell him all about the case after the first day of jury selection.
So it all depends on how strong the admonition is that the judge gives the jurors. If the judge gives the standard admonition that, you know, this defendant's entitled to a fair trial, and in order to make sure that he gets a fair trial, you cannot go on the internet, you cannot get evidence from any other source other than what you hear in the courtroom and the law that I give you. That's kind of the standard admonition. And if that's all the judge does, there's a good chance that one or more of the jurors, either for stealth reasons. So a stealth juror is a juror that comes in with an agenda. So jurors that go on the internet to do research, they do it for one or two reasons. Either they're looking for reasons to want to convict the person on trial, or what's much more frequent is people really want to do a good job as a juror, and they want as much information as possible. And we're in the day and age of Google, and so now when we want to learn something, it's real natural for us to go to Google. So there's some jurors do it for nefarious reasons, and other jurors do it for well-intended reasons. But it doesn't matter. Either way, whether it's nefarious or well-intended, there's no business. Jurors have no business going online and getting extrajudicial, in other words, information outside the courtroom, extrajudicial information. There's no place for that in our justice system. If the judge gives the standard charge, the standard admonition, there's a chance the jurors are going to do it. If he gives an enhanced admonition, if he tells the jurors, if anybody goes online and does any research, they're going to be in contempt of court, punishable by a fine or imprisonment, that might dissuade jurors from going online. And I really hope that the lawyers in this case ask the judge to make such a strong admonition, because this is one of those cases where if this man is convicted, he's going to be convicted because of innuendo. He's going to be convicted of race. He's going to be convicted because he's generally a bad hombre, as we say in Texas. He's not going to be convicted based on the evidence, because I'm telling you and your listeners that the evidence in this case is razor thin, razor thin. There's not one in this day and age of CSI, in this day and age of physical evidence, of this day and age of empirical evidence that can link a defendant to a crime scene. DNA is the classic example. The fact that there is a complete, utter failure to have any physical evidence linking this defendant to a charge of rape and murder is just unfathomable. It's hard to believe that in this day and age that there's not a scintilla of physical DNA type evidence linking this defendant to this horrific crime. Let's make no mistake about it. This is a horrific crime. But the only thing that's almost as horrific would be convicting an innocent person.
An Iowa appellate court ordered a new trial for Sandy Liggins for two reasons. It found that a previous prosecutor had not turned over more than 70 reports to the defense. Some of those reports may have contained evidence pointing away from Liggins committing the crime. Also, it was never revealed that an eyewitness in the case had been a paid police informant in 87 other cases. Just how the defense will use this information remains to be seen, but Hirschhorn has suggestions.
All my client wants is a fair trial. All my client wants is all the evidence that is admissible, proper admissible evidence to come out. And if there's an alternative suspect, and the DA was sitting on information about this alternative suspect, the lawyer is going to bring it out big time. And B, I say shame on those prosecutors for not disclosing that information.
Bill Davis, the Scott County attorney at the time, insists he turned the reports over.
My position is, and I take it to my grave, those reports were given to the first set of lawyers because somehow they got lost and didn't get to the second lawyer. Not my fault, but I got blamed for it. I never hit a report in my life. And they were innocuous, but now they photocopy and make them sign for everything so that we can document they got it. But we didn't have that system. That was my fault. Didn't have the system at that time. So the court concluded that we had hid those files from them and done it with purpose, and that if the defense had had that, they might have mounted a better defense and it might have changed the jury's mind.
But Hirschhorn, who is not involved with this case, isn't buying it.
Yeah, well, I think the prosecutor or the police or both of them are full of shit. Because all they're trying to do is to manipulate the system. Again, I want to start out by saying this is a horrific crime. What happened to that poor child and that family is unforgivable. But we can't just take the person that the police or the prosecutors say is the person who committed this crime and convict them unless there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's sorely lacking in this case. And to fail to turn over exculpatory evidence, there's just no excuse for that. And for the prosecutors to say, yeah, I did turn it over, I mean, all they're doing is continuing to lie. I mean, look, that's all it is. I mean, I can promise you, if that kind of report is turned over to even a C-grade lawyer, to a first-year criminal defense lawyer, they know the value of that kind of information. The prosecutor didn't turn over that information. All he turned over was another lie, as far as I'm concerned.
So here's the question. You have this. The other issue that came up in the reason he's getting a new trial is you have this witness that had been a paid police informant in 87 other cases. Now, those cases were mostly were after the murder, but before the trial. So, but this is obviously a financial relationship between the police department and the defendant, or between the police department and the witness, and that should have been disclosed. So how do you go about, if you were cross-examining this this woman, how would you go about doing it?
Well, I have 87 files. And it would be the 87, I'd take her through each of the 87 times that she had been a witness for the prosecution in the past and what kind of benefits she received from that. But more importantly, what's important to me about that is it's not so much, look, a rat's a rat, all right? This is a professional rat. And all this person is doing is they're a crook, they're a criminal, they're gigging the system. They know that if they give the prosecutor some information that they want, they'll get a better deal. They're you know, scum of the criminal justice system. The more important issue is, was this information turned over by the district attorney's office to the criminal offense lawyers? Did they turn this information over that this witness had worked 87 times? as a police informant in the past. Did they do that prior to this witness testifying?
Well, they did not, but they said they didn't know that she had been a paid police informant in these for the police department.
Okay, so now they're liars and they're stupid, these prosecutors? I don't think so. They seem to have real convenient answers to stuff. Oh, I thought we turned it over. Oh, I didn't know that it was an informant 87 times. Anybody that's been an informant 87 times, people know about it. This is not done in a vacuum. This is not done in secret. Everybody knows in terms of the law enforcement side. And what they're trying to do, once again, is they're playing cute. And they're not turning over information that they know the defense is entitled to. And they know the defense would beat them over the head with, which is exactly why they didn't turn it over. And for the prosecutor to claim, oh, I didn't know this person had been informant 87 times, tells me that this prosecutor cares more about a result than making sure that justice is done. And I say to that prosecutor, shame on you. You should get your ticket punched.
The case has long had strong racial overtones. Sandy Liggins is black. Jennifer Lewis was white. The panel of 41 prospective jurors has about 5 African Americans on it.
Yeah, okay. So each side has 10 peremptory strikes that they can exercise against any juror they want. Now, they don't have to subscribe a reason, but under a Supreme Court case called Batson versus Kentucky, you cannot systematically exclude. You cannot take jurors off preemptorily based on their race. There's another case that says you can't do it based on gender. So what we want to look for is, of those 4 or 5 remaining African Americans that are on the panel, we want to see how many of those the state exercised a peremptory strike on. My guess is, if I had a guess right now, if there's, say, 5, my guess is they're going to exercise 3 to 4 peremptory strikes to black jurors.
Why 3 to 4?
Because if they use a peremptory strike on every single black juror, it's going to be crystal clear what they're doing. I mean, it's clear that all they're trying to do is eliminate all the black jurors. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. Okay, so what prosecutors like to do is they like to be able to say, hey, we didn't exercise all our peremptory strikes to African-American jurors. There's 1 or 2 African-American jurors that are still serving on the jury. And unfortunately, that's not what the United States Supreme Court said in Batson. What Batson says is that if even 1 African-American juror is excluded based on race, that's improper. So I think the way prosecutors try to get around Batson and try to play cute with the court is they look at the 5, let's say in this case it's 5 African-American jurors. They look at the 5 and they say to themselves, of these 5, who are most likely to be followers? Who are the ones that are least likely to have a big voice back in the jury room? And they will leave 1 or 2 of those folks on. And then the stronger African-American jurors, they'll take them off. Because look, I firmly believe in this case that race is an undertone. It's the elephant in the room. And black jurors, if they get back there that have a strong voice, they're going to be able to persuade many of those other jurors that this case is very weak on evidence and that this man is being scapegoated. Because he's black, he's being scapegoated for this crime.
I'm speaking with reporter Scott Reeder. He's covering the criminal trial of Stanley Liggins in Waterloo, Iowa. Jury selection continued today in the Black Hawk County Courthouse. Selection process began yesterday when well over 100 potential jurors packed the courtroom. Scott joins me now over Skype. Scott, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here. Great to be here.
So when we last spoke Tuesday night, there wasn't much to report since so much of the jury selection process goes on behind closed doors. But have the doors begun to open, so to speak? Do you have a clear picture of who the chosen jurors might be? Have prosecutors and Liggins' attorney been able to whittle down the jury pool at all?
Yeah, they have. They started out with 170 jurors, potential jurors, I should say. And then the process is to whittle that down to a panel of 41 jurors. And then from that panel of 41, they will pick 12 people to be on the jury and three alternates. Now, so that's where they're at. They got a panel of 41. It's a diverse group. I believe there are at least four African Americans in the jury pool. Maybe five. There's one person we weren't quite sure, looking at him, what his racial makeup was. And I always feel a little bit uncomfortable assigning a racial category to somebody, because you can be a lot of different things. But that's part of the nature of this. And this is a very, race plays a heavy role in this case, like it or not. I mean, the defendant is African American, the victim was white. There's going to be allegations of police misconduct in this case. That those always come with allegations of racial bias and other things. So that weighs heavy here, but it's a diverse group. It was interesting. They took it out from behind closed doors and they started questioning the whole panel of 40-some jurors all at once. And today was the prosecution's turn. And they were asking questions like, some of them were very innocuous questions like, hey, are you married? Where do you work? What's your wife do? What's your husband do? Can you make a decision if you're not absolutely positively certain? Does it have to be 100% in your mind? If you think somebody is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, can you vote to convict? They ask if they'd had prior jury service. They ask a lot of questions. And it was interesting listening to the jurors when they would discuss this, a few jurors said, I really don't want to be here. I don't want to be on this jury. I'll serve if I have to, but this is something I really don't want to do. But here's the secret about jury duty. Most people want to be on the jury. I've been a reporter for 30 years. I've seen this time and time again. Most people honestly would like to be selected to be on a jury. So that was an interesting dynamic to watch as well.
But would they really like to be on this jury for a trial that the judge has warned will likely take up to four weeks?
Yeah, I mean, some people were very concerned. You heard folks say things like, that would be hard to be away from. One was a convenience store manager, and she said, the place is going to go to pieces without me there. I know that. And they said, well, you've been gone 2 days. Have you checked in to see how things are going? No, I haven't. But you had other people say, I can do this. This is something that's important to me. This is an opportunity to do something, give something back to our community. So it went the whole spectrum, to be honest with you. There was a few there that were obviously trying hard to get off the jury, but for the most part, the people were there and doing their duty and wanted to be there.
So today on Wednesday, prosecutors had their chance to ask potential jurors questions, and Thursday is when the defense team will. Do you have any idea what kinds of questions they're going to ask?
Well, I think they're going to ask some very similar questions, but I think they're also going to ask questions probably, if I was going to bet, I haven't talked to the defense team, but typically they'll ask questions, do you give the police more credibility than ordinary citizens? Do you think a police officer's more or less likely to lie than somebody else? Do you try to get a sense for people who may have a certain reverence for law enforcement? That obviously be some folks that they didn't want to have on this jury, because if you're going to be going after how an investigation was done. You don't want somebody to think that, gee, the police are almost always right. You know, you're going to have that. You're going to have, one of the things I noticed is, in a way, it was kind of like opening statements light today. I mean, the prosecution was making, explaining things to jurors like, if I touch this chair and then wipe the chair, my fingerprints are no longer there. Does that mean that I'm not here? Well, just because you have the absence of evidence, physical evidence, doesn't mean that something's not there. So he was making the argument because this case has had thousands of items tested and checked back in 1990, and they never could able to find any evidence of Stanley Liggins' DNA or fingerprints or anything else at the scene where Jennifer was found. They didn't find anything, any evidence of Jennifer being at Stanley's apartment. They didn't find anything linking the two as far as forensic evidence linking the two together. So, you know, there was a garbage bag that was Jennifer was wrapped in that was similar or the same brand that was sold at the long-term hotel that Stanley Liggins lived at. But that's about the extent of what I would call forensic evidence pointing towards Stanley Liggins in particular. So, yeah, that's...
Tell me about the prosecutors. I understand that's a brother-sister duo.
It sure is. And that was interesting. When Mike Walton got up and he was talking to the jury panel, he said, "You probably have noticed that Julie and I have the same last name. We're brother and sister." And the entire room seemed to be a bit amused by that. I think some people had probably assumed that they were husband and wife. Some other people hadn't thought about them maybe not being related. And then he explained how they both ended up coming to work at the Scott County Attorney's Office. I think he was trying to make it really clear that, no, he didn't hire his sister to work for him. They both got hired on as assistants about the same time. And just was trying to make that really clear to folks that, you know, and, you know, when usually in a courtroom, obviously, attorneys are very formal with each other. They'll refer to each other as Mr. or Ms. And Julie Walton just said, "I'm sorry, I can't refer to my brother as Mr. Walton. He's Mike." And she would just refer to him that way. And he would refer to her as Julie. And I think that was a good way for that team to kind of develop a rapport with the jury as well.
And who is the defense team for Liggins? Does he just have one attorney, two attorneys, public defender? Who does he have?
He has two. One, they're both public defenders. Nicole Watt and Aaron Hawbaker. I believe that is how you pronounce his name. And they seem very capable and very determined. And I was impressed with them as well. We haven't had a chance to hear them speak yet. So tomorrow is really kind of be their debut with the jury when they start asking questions and interacting.
And after that, once they are done, Liggins' defense team is done asking the jury pool questions. Are they then expected to choose a final jury?
Yes. What will happen is, you know, as we said in yesterday's episode, it's really a misnomer to say they're selecting a jury. They're eliminating a lot of people. And then whoever's left is who the jury is. So basically, the prosecutors are looking for people they don't like to be on this jury, and the defense is looking for people they don't like to be on this jury. And then what you end up with at the end is who's ever's left, you know? So, most people anticipate that tomorrow, or excuse me, that on Thursday, that we will have a full jury.
And once the full jury is arrived at, are opening statements immediately going to follow? Could that be as early as Thursday, or might that begin Friday?
I'm anticipating opening statements tomorrow.
Okay, great. Was there anything else you wanted to mention, Scott?
Well, yeah. There were a couple things that I don't know if you noticed. We had a little bit of technical difficulty yesterday when we were doing some recording, and some things came out distorted. But I was going to talk to you a little bit about the questionnaire. We didn't put this in our episode yesterday, but we might, or today. But a couple of things that struck me is on this is the way some of the questions that were asked of all the potential jurors, like, are there any reasons you cannot sit on a jury involving a homicide or a sexual abuse allegation? Have you ever, or have you or any member of your family or someone close to you ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Have you or any member of your family or someone close to you ever been accused of sexual abuse? Have you or any member of your family or someone close to you ever been the victim of a homicide? Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you were the victim of a homicide, I don't think you'd be available to take the survey, would you?
No, that would be a very difficult question to answer, I suppose.
Well, I wouldn't think so. I mean, victims are 6 feet under.
You were the victim, if you were the victim, so.
So those are kind of the basic questions that were asked at the beginning of jurors, and now they're just asking much more specific questions. And there's a bit of art and science going on here. You know, you're looking at body language, trying to see how jurors interact. You're looking at the questions that they answer. And I would suspect that both teams have investigators. I would suspect that those teams are investigating these jurors a little bit. I mean, especially the ones that have served on other juries, you think they might be wanting to look back and see what verdict they reached before when they were on a jury. You know, things like that, I think, would be they're probably looking into. They're probably looking into if they had ever had brushes with the law in the past. Yep. Those sort of things. So I would suspect that there's a lot of things like that that are they're playing into the mix.
And so you just mentioned among the questions these potential jurors are being asked is about sex abuse. If they've been the victim or if they've been the perpetrator, why are they being asked this about sex abuse in a murder case?
You know, that's a good question. Well, you know, Jennifer was taken somewhere, sexually assaulted, strangled, and then taken to another place, the school playground, where she was dumped and doused with gasoline and set on fire. So there are elements of sex abuse in this crime, as well as murder. What the question is, you know, if you have been the victim of sex abuse or know somebody that has been, are you going to react in a very emotional way to hearing this information and saying somebody should pay for this or not? I'll be honest with you, Ben. I don't know if you know this about me. I wrote a column on it earlier this year. But, you know, when I was 12 years old, I was sexually assaulted. And, you know, when I was reading that question, I kind of cringed a little bit. It's like this thought that just because you've gone through this experience that you're not going to you're going to react in a very emotional way to this crime. You may be more likely to be empathetic, or you may have some insight that other jurors don't. I mean, it doesn't automatically eliminate you, but I kind of found the question a little bit off-putting, to be honest with you.
See. Well, is there anything else you wanted to mention, Scott?
Well, there's a few things that kind of bothered me. The judge kept and the court attendants kept telling the jurors, you cannot have your cell phones on in here. That doesn't mean have them on silent. That means don't have your cell phones on. The judge kept giving instructions to the jury, don't avoid all media. And yet we saw a juror sitting there reading the newspaper in the jury room while they're going through selection. And I, in the back row where I was sitting, there were three jurors on their phones. And it's like, okay. The question that comes to my mind, and, you know, maybe the judge has ordered that jurors do not conduct their own research or investigations, that they don't get online and find out information on this case. And that's the way it should be. But the question is that the way it will be? Will the jurors that get selected with avoid the temptation for a month and not get online and look up information on this case? Because there's an awful lot of information on this case, things that they don't want jurors to know, like that Stanley Liggins failed his polygraph test, and that's why they focused the investigation on him. Or that Stanley Liggins was selling drugs and to Jennifer's parents. The Iowa Supreme Court threw out the first conviction because they said that was prejudicial. There's a lot of things in this case. Another thing that they don't want the jurors to know is that a month before Jennifer was murdered, that Stanley Liggins sexually abused another 9-year-old girl. And that happened in Milan, Illinois. And he was convicted in that case. And
that conviction is upheld. That one was never overturned.
No, that was never overturned. It was an Illinois conviction. I think he was sentenced to 7 years. That was served concurrently with the murder case from Iowa. But what struck me on that is they don't want the jurors to know that. They think that's way over prejudicial. Just because he was involved in something similar, the argument goes, doesn't mean he did this crime, and that we need to focus on this crime and this crime only. But, you know, if a juror were to get online, they'd probably come across this podcast, Suspect Convictions, if they did a search for Stanley Liggins, and they would find out pretty quickly, oh yes, there was this woman that this girl that he assaulted. And in fact, in one of our past episodes, we interviewed the woman, and, you know, it's a pretty horrific thing that she went through. So those are things they don't want the jurors to hear or know. But how do you hold back 12 people or 15 people, if you count the alternates, from finding this stuff out? You know, potential juror said to him that his wife's a bit of a gossip. And that when he got home from jury duty last night, she knew more about the case than he did. You know, she'd been investigating it. You know, I just can't help but think that there are going to be some people that are going to be very tempted to find stuff out about this case. Or if not them, family members, you know, like, you know. They're not seeing, you know, their husband or wife for 3 weeks until evening. And gosh, I wonder what this case that they're involved in is all about. And that people will look it up and then have a very strong compulsion to talk to their spouse who's on the jury when they get home. There's a lot of things like that really are interesting to me. And I don't know how. It's so different, Ben, than when I started in the news business. You know, 30 years ago when I covered courts in Galveston, Texas, all you had to do was tell the jurors, don't read the local paper. And that was about the extent of it. You can go the length of the trial, don't read the paper, and you'll be fine. Well, now, like a retrial like this, and when you had a lot of media coverage, even when you do a change of venue, a lot of you still have ready access to those stories that were written 20, 30 years ago on this case. I mean, the internet gives us so much more power for information than we had back in those days. And I don't know how a court really can address that. I mean, it's a tough, tough thing. And I don't really have answers to that.
And you mentioned that you saw some people in the courtroom, some potential jurors checking their phones while was reading a newspaper. Does the courtroom, the courthouse in Black Hawk County not have a policy of checking phones at the door?
No, they don't. You can bring your phones in. That's very different than Scott County, Iowa, where you have to, only lawyers and journalists and a few other people can bring their phones in. In Black Hawk County, everybody can bring them in. There's no rule against it. But yeah, they have, and I don't think any of those jurors were doing research on the case. I think they were playing video games on their phones, or they were reading something or doing something else just to occupy a lot of empty time. And the juror I saw reading in the newspaper was reading the sports section. But you know, the order was given don't consume media, you know, avoid right. that.
Well, thanks for joining me, Scott.
It's wonderful to be here.